Welcome to Terminal Value. So everything I do here at Terminal Value is based around one big question, and that is, how do growth-oriented people transform their business and their life to achieve world-class levels of value in everything they do? That is the question, and I am here to bring you the answers. My name is Doug Utberg, and this is Terminal Value. I publish new podcast episodes 5 times per week. So make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any content. And also make sure to follow me on social. You can just look for the Doug Utberg handle. Please comment and let me know your thoughts. I'm looking forward to working together so that we can make your life amazing. Welcome to the Terminal Value Podcast. We have Thomas Douglas with us today of adaptordie.com, and we are going to be talking about the algorithm of success. And what Thomas has done, and one of the reasons why he's coming to us today, is he's actually built a highly successful, what's called MSP, or managed service provider. And so in information technology speak, what that means is companies, instead of having a full internal information technology staff, what they'll do is they'll partner with an agency who handles the majority of their IT operations for them, and sometimes will handle their IT development for them also. So anyway, Thomas, don't let me go on too long. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate that. A very awesome intro, and you've nailed it. A managed service provider steps in and helps to close the gap. We describe it in such a way that we manage IT for our clients to protect their business and to help them grow. And fundamentally, that's what we've focused on. And we've been really fortunate over the last several years to grow. We operate now in about 43 states, and we support about 20,000 devices. So we've grown a lot, hit the Inc. 5,000 9 times in a row. So we've done a lot of these things. And what I learned along the way is that I skinned my knee and had lots of bumps and bruises. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find a way to make sure that others didn't have to go through some of those challenges. And so I wrote the book, adaptordie.com, where I describe the algorithm of success, which are the components that every organization needs to get right to make sure that they're successful in what they do.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, so what are some of the key points from this algorithm of success? Because I think, right, there's a lot of success literature out there. There are some common themes. And oddly enough, there are some contradicting themes.
Sure.
And so that's actually one of the things that's been very unique about running this podcast is I've been able to absorb a lot of different perspectives of success. There are, they generally flow in a common direction, but mm-hmm. I've noticed that everybody has a viewpoint that's just a little bit different.
Sure. Yeah. Well, their own experiences and nuances of their business, I'm sure, drives a little bit of that. And certainly verticals make a difference, but as a whole, we believe that fundamentally organizations need to start by first understanding what their product is, which sounds simple, but it's not always. What I describe in the book and through the algorithm is that the product is actually a promise. And that promise has to be met, and your sales and marketing has to identify to the buyer or the prospect what those promises are. And it has to either solve a pain point or, achieve the pleasure or the positive thing they're looking for as a part of that. And what's unique about those products, and understand then from that product who their target client profile actually is. So who are they trying to sell to? How do they operate? And one of the fun things that we did as a part of all of it is with every section of the algorithm, there are worksheets that you can get on the Adaptordie website by registering on there. They're all free. All you have to do is put in where you bought the book. I mean, it's $10 for thousands of dollars worth of assets. Yeah. And so we walk through things like the target client profile, the worksheet, where we ask questions like, where do they spend their time? How do they like to spend their free time? How do they expand their knowledge? Because it's those things that then inform the marketing feeds it. And then that feeds directly into the strategy, which is an area I know that you guys spend the majority of your time, but how fast do I want to grow the business? How much do I want it to be worth? How do I want to consider exits in the future? And then, which informs obviously your sales strategy. How many products do I need to sell at what gross margin dollars that create what EBITDA values in the organization and things like that. And so we walk all the way from the strategy, and then we build the growth engine. And then from there, we get into the financial model to make sure that it's sustainable and handle scale. And then from there, we go people, operations, and process. And with the overarching theme of leadership that you've got to get nailed down. And so in the book, it's written in such a way where it's a fable, if you will, that takes concepts and then weaves them into the storyline so that it's really practical for people to understand how to apply the principles in real life and not some theory.
Gotcha. All right. Well, this is a very mechanical approach, which I think is good because one of the many things I'm kind of fond of saying is that, it's usually strategy and stuff like that that sells books, but at least half of your organization's values comes from its operations. Uh-huh. Because a strategy you can't execute isn't a strategy.
That's correct.
It sounds like a lot of your philosophy is really around getting down to the operational level with everything that you're doing, which would make complete sense for if you're trying to run an MSP, because an MSP that doesn't have highly dialed in operations will be a nest of eternal chaos.
Yeah, it's a fact. Yeah, you know the industry well.
Before my current endeavors, I spent 20 years in corporate finance and information technology. I was working for Intel Corp and Lattice Semiconductor, and I ran the program management office at Lattice for a couple of years. So I've had more interactions than I would care to admit.
I'm sure that's accurate. Yeah, and I'm sure not all of them positive.
The very nature of IT is that nobody pays attention to until there's a problem.
So. Exactly. Yeah, if you do it well, it's kind of invisible. It just works all the time.
Correct.
Yeah, but you have absolutely nailed it. I mean, when you think about whether it's an IT company or some of the examples that I use inside the book or law firms and CPA firms, professional service organizations, it's how do you take the product and the strategy for that and then navigate it inside the organization so that you're building the operations and the processes to make sure that you're keeping the promises that you're selling in the first place. And as I'm sure you've run across more times than you can count, you get introduced to the sales guy who makes all these grand promises, and then the operational people get in for service delivery or whatever it is. And it's like, what the hell are you talking about? I have no idea. We can't do that. And that's not what we want. We want to make sure that the processes and the delivery of operations absolutely matches the marketing and the sales, the promises and the strategy that it takes to get the business to the next level. And so we walk through some of the challenges in making sure that there's synergies, an overused word, but that those exist, and that how you get that clarity in the conversations that actually need to occur within the business to make sure that you've got buy-in from everybody in the organization to keep those promises and create that value.
Yeah, well, and creating that linkage, what it seems to me that a place that would be really important is, in that sales to that marketing sales to operations handoff. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of cases, what will happen is, as you just alluded to, operations will want to underpromise, and then of course sales will want to overpromise. And so it's like what you almost need to do is you need to stretch both ends in opposite directions. Instead of operations say, okay, don't tell me what we can do 100 times out of 100. What can we do with 85% confidence? What does pushing look like? Yes. And then then sales needs to understand, okay, this is the base proposal. This is how far you can push it. And if we go past there, we're getting into the realm of unexecutable. Right. But of course, the natural space for operations is going to be, what's the 100% reliability promise? Well, that's almost guaranteed to be uncompetitive.
Exactly.
It will be extremely boring, and it will be very similar to everybody else's, and it will probably be slower and more expensive. Yes. On the other hand, on the sales side, their natural inclination is going to be to more or less promise whatever they need to get the sale. Mm-hmm. Which can put you in the situation of having an unexecutable agreement.
Yes, you're exactly right. And unfortunately, years ago, we ran into both ends of that spectrum. We had salespeople that absolutely overpromised and said yes to everything. It's like, can you do that? Yes. Can you do that? Yes. Yeah, we're perfect. We can do everything. And then the operations guys that you're talking to get that order, and they're like, what is this? There is no way we can be successful in that. So we learned from that. We matured our organization, and the way that we handled it was to get both of those parties in the same room. And they both helped us to write the proposals and the agreements and the documents, proposals and the contracts essentially mirror exactly what we're capable of with those stretch goals in mind. Because when you have the sales guys looking at the operations guys going, hey, there's no way I can sell this. And if I don't sell it, you don't get a career. You don't get an advancement, right. You don't get the promotion because we're not growing. And, you know, the old saying, if you're not growing, you're dying. And sales guys push that in those meetings, and the operations guys, okay, we can get on board with that. And here's how we could do it. Let's go make sure that our processes mirror what we're talking about in here.
Yeah.
And when you force those conversations, man, it's magic, and it really accelerates the business and builds the enthusiasm that you want your team to have when they're out in front of a prospect.
Yeah, well, and I think taking this this idea just a little further, first came onto this when I was reading the material of Dr. Eli Goldratt, who unfortunately passed away in 2011. He was the proprietor of the idea of theory of constraints. You know, I'm sure he's not the first person to think of the idea of bottlenecks, constraints, etc. But the whole idea behind TOC was to create a sustainable operational advantage. You know, basically by identifying and then optimizing around the constraint of your throughput flow. And because one of the things he extended in some of his further books was the idea that, you know, what, you know, once you have that operational advantage, you can actually use that to create sales and marketing offers that other people will have a very difficult time matching, you know, because of course, if you cut price, the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to get shopped to somebody else, and then they're going to cut you by another 5%. And then you'll have to cut them by another 5%. And at some point, somebody will say uncle, and nobody will have any margins left. But, you know, I think what the game is really about is, you know, creating that partnership between sales and operations, and then figuring out how do you create an executable offer, you know, not executable exactly the way we do things today, but how do we, you know, how do we optimize our operations so that we create an offer other people can't easily match that is still executable by us? Because then you can take that out into the market and you can't get shopped exactly. Or if you do get shopped, somebody else is going to have to put something out that might be unexecutable for them, at which point you will eventually get the business.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And what happens in those circumstances from our own experiences, and we talk about it in the book as well, is that you create and you force the organization to innovate when you go through those conversations. And that's what you want, because if your product stays stagnant, obviously your customers are going to get frustrated over time, you're going to lose market share and all of those things. And so by constantly pushing on the sales and service, well, what do we have to do that's unique that's going to beat our competitor? Creativity comes to life, because at the end of the day, the engineers and the operations, you know, people, as you described it, they want what's 100% success. And it's like, well, you know, what is the stretch? Like you said earlier, but what do we need to innovate so that we are staying ahead of our competitors or creating that unique selling proposition? And when an organization gets into a habit and a routine of that, where that becomes part of the DNA, then it's a lot of fun, and it drives that enthusiasm about where the business is going. So going back to the full strategy conversation, then when you get that clarity there, and you have a true north of where the company's going, and you can communicate that through the organization, then the product, the service delivery, the operations of the organization become the pathway to achieve that outcome, with the engine being the sales and marketing team. And when you get that magic going, then that's when you accelerate down the road and hit the Inc. 5000, things like that.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, you know, because especially, you know, when you have that kind of thing dialed in, and, you know, and then you're, especially if you get a really good idea of, you know, what your marketing to, you know, kind of what your marketing spend to, you know, to lead generation to, you know, to conversion closure percentage and that timeline looks like, you know, once you get really good numbers on that, then that's when you can start to grow fast, because you can say, okay, if I put $300,000 into marketing, then that means it's going to turn into somewhere between $400,000 and $900,000 of additional revenue within the next 2 to 12 months. When you can get it down to that level of detail, that's when you can really grow fast. Because of course, at least what I've observed is the thing that stymies a lot of businesses, a lot of small, medium, even, well, probably not so much larger size businesses, although partly, you know, is that you don't really know what that return is going to be if you put another $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, $900,000 into marketing. It might drive the curve up, and then again, it might not. And I think this is actually what happens in like really, really large companies, you know, because like at like, you know, when I was over at Intel, I would have marketing, I'd have people over in marketing say, okay, Doug, I'd like you to get an analysis to try to figure out how much revenue we're going to drive by spending another $10 million in marketing. I'm like, it's probably going to be none. Because you know, you're talking a $60 billion company. It's not going to be noticeable.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, $10 million one way or the other on top of however many billions in marketing they spent, like, you know, six or 10 or something. It might not have been that much, but yeah, multiple billions of dollars in marketing makes no difference. You know, the overwhelming majority of, you know, of your branding, marketing, et cetera, is the co-branding that goes out through the partners.
Right.
But of course, everybody's trying to get a specific ROI on their 100,000 or half million or million or 5 million or 10 million. And it really doesn't matter on the why, you know, and it just ends up being too small to move the needle, which, you know, from a large company perspective, probably means all that little ticky-tacky stuff really isn't that necessary anyway. But, you know, kind of getting it back to the small, mid-sized company, if you're going to drop $100,000 of extra marketing, you want to have a pretty good idea what you're going to get for it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we describe it as return on sales. And so you need to know your numbers. And, you know, I had a mentor tell me one time, when you figure these things out, the ultimate goal is that when you push on the gas pedal, it goes. And you know exactly what you said. You know that if I drop $100,000 in, I'm going to get $900,000 out in whatever time frame is reasonable for your industry. Sometimes you can realize it in a year, and then I think that's awesome. A lot of organizations, you know, your sales cycles, you know, because of agreement terms or because of life cycle, whatever it may be, it may be, you know, 24 months, but you need to know those numbers so that you can measure sales constantly and then know that, okay, I'm going to intentionally invest, you know, an additional chunk of cash, whatever it is, and this is what I should expect, and then put those measurables in place for your sales leaders or for whomever is going to be driving those initiatives so that there's accountability to that ROI or that return on sales.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and then I think the other thing that you would ideally want to bring this into as well is to figure out what is your operational capacity, because the absolute last thing you want to do is push down the gas pedal on your sales. And now you, you know, bring in, say, like three times as many clients as you can operationally support. So now you will either need to turn people away or, well, maybe not give them an intentional bad experience, but intentionally give them an experience that you know you can't really deliver on.
That's 100% right. And that is why having such a strong leadership foundation inside the organization is just absolutely critical, because you've got to have that constant communication. So how big is the funnel? What are our forecasts? What's going on inside the business that we need to be aware of on the sales side? And then what are the constraints on the operational side? So if we're successful in the execution of our sales strategy and we grow by, you know, 5X, 10X, whatever it is, what levers do we need to pull on the operations or in the delivery team in order to make sure we're keeping those promises? And I, you know, we're going to be launching a course in a few months, and in it, I talk about how important it is to have promise keepers within the operations department. Yeah. Like, their whole job is to keep the promises that were made by sales, but nobody in sales can make a promise unless the promise keeper signed off on it first. Have those agreements in place to make sure that there's clarity through the organization that feeds back to the strategy, that feeds back to the clarity of where you want to go and how quickly you want to get there.
Got it. All right. Well, hey, we've covered a lot of ground in the last 20 minutes or so. Well, okay. So let's, you know, as we're starting to get to the end of our conversation, you know, so give us your last two or three thoughts as far as, you know, the pieces that we might not have had time to delve into really on what that success algorithm looks like. I think we've actually had a pretty holistic conversation, but there's always parts that you miss.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the big things that we really haven't spent too much time talking about today that's kind of in the middle of everything are what I describe as people puzzles. And the challenge with a small to medium-sized business is that oftentimes you have a great entrepreneur, has great ideas and has a great heart, but not always a lot of experience navigating through the people problems and the people challenges that exist, whether it's performance issues or personal issues or a manager not knowing how to deal with the challenge or communicate very well, whatever those people puzzles are. And so we spend a reasonable amount of time in the book helping people to navigate through those conversations and have them in a positive way. There's a couple of things that I think are pretty critical as it relates to that. One, I think that if anytime you approach a problem, if you talk to the person with honor and respect, it's always going to end in a much better place. And so often we let our emotions get away from us, and that honor and respect isn't first. it comes in the apology afterwards, but the problem isn't approached with that. And then two, I think appreciation is the currency for motivation. So making sure that you appreciate your team and work through those. We have a philosophy or a process that we teach within in the book that there's worksheets to support as well that are actually pretty awesome that are called the three P's when it comes to problem solving.
Yeah.
Which it starts with, is it a product problem? Is it a process problem? Or is it a people problem? And you can almost always solve a business problem by identifying it through these P's. And so there's a process that we work through to identify that, what the next steps are and how you get clear on those things to make sure that you're iterating properly in the business and actually putting your energy where it needs to go rather than just pointing a finger and saying, well, it's Lou's fault. If he would have just ... then everything would have been fine. It's like, well, no, he was never trained. There's not even a process built around that. How could you expect Lou to be successful?
Yeah.
So challenging that status quo to make sure that because we lead with honor and respect, that we assume, you know, that this person has been trained or that they have the processes or that the product is accurate or doing what it's supposed to do. Well, let's test those things. Let's verify those things first before we blame Lou. And through doing that, we've seen some pretty incredible outcomes.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, and I think that last part right there is especially important. I think just because I think the 1990s era workplace is really gone. And of course, you know, and then B, it's actually rather toxic to your culture if you let too much subjectivity come into your performance evaluation process. And, you know, just my observation is that even most quote unquote meritocracy based performance rating processes are still usually based on people's perceptions, at which point you have a lot of subjectivity. So any way that you can bring in objectivity, or alternatively, if you just be upfront about where your perception based versus what is and isn't objective.
Yes.
I was just wanted to say, that's a little bit of a sore point for me, just because I spent a long time in the tech industry and everybody claims to be a meritocracy, but when it comes down to it, it's really a bunch of people in a room arguing, and they usually argue in favor of the people on their team.
Yeah. that's a fact. Yeah. I believe and share over and over and over that you have to learn to love the truth even when you don't like it. And so when you focus on the facts and you focus on the truth, then you can kind of scrape away all the emotions and the perceptions, because you're talking about very subjective, very specific pieces and points of data that the decisions are made on or that the conversations are focused on. So fall in love with the truth.
Yeah. Outstanding. Outstanding. Well, hey, Thomas, really appreciate your time on the show today.
Hey, thanks for letting me be a part of it. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Terminal Value Podcast. So if you liked this episode, please share it on your favorite social media and tag me, and then tell me what you did or didn't like about this episode so that I will know what to create for you. And in addition, I would like to share with you the most incredible free gift ever. What I am going to do is I am going to give you a 3-day, 4-night vacation at one of 30 destinations across the United States completely free, with no obligation at all, no timeshare pitch, nothing. In addition to that, what I am going to do is I am going to do a complimentary savings assessment for your business so that you will understand whether it makes sense for us to work together so that I can help to save you money. The value of this offer is literally between thousands and millions of dollars depending on your business. But even if you don't have a business, if you know somebody who does, I would like to extend that offer to them and still provide a free vacation to you. So just go to offer.terminalvalue.biz right now and enter your information so that I can bring your free vacation to you. Remember, that is offer.terminalvalue.biz, and I am looking forward to talking with you.